Hello and welcome to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco. The UK mortgage market has seen a number of regulatory changes since the 2008 crash. The best known are the Mortgage Market Review of Residential Loans and the Prudential Regulation Authority Review of Buy to Let. The landscape that ensued has actually enabled a burgeoning of loan providers, increasing competition and flexibility. But it can be really complicated, and in this programme we will explore some of the key factors to take into account when applying for residential, buy-to-let and short-term finance. Well, with me in the studio are Scott Hendry, Director of Auction Relationships at Together Money, Nick Blunt, Director of One and All Financial Services, who is a broker, and also on the line from Cardiff is Morgan Stewart, another broker. He's Principal at GPS Financial. Well, let me start first of all with you, Nick. I wanted to ask you about residential loans. Now, one of the issues, of course, is sources of income, because that's going to be the main driver, really, in terms of how much you can borrow. But lenders differ, don't they, in what they require for self-employed and employed applicants. What are the sorts of issues that they take into account?
Yeah, they most definitely do. Common to both is the maximum age that lenders will lend to an applicant now, which obviously impacts on the affordability for that particular applicant. Then now these people tend to, or what we are seeing is that there are many people who historically have had interest-only mortgages and have fallen out of those interest-only mortgages at the end, where the lender is looking to get payment back of all of their monies, and they're coming to us looking to see what options are open to them. So we are seeing a lot of people falling into the residential interest-only mortgage and even into the later life lending.
And typically for interest-only, you'd need income of £75,000, or there's often a minimum, isn't there?
Indeed there is, yeah, absolutely. Mm. Certain lenders have certain different criteria, so it is a bit of a minefield. But going back to the actual question with regard to the employed and the self-employed people, so the difference is that lenders struggle to actually pigeonhole or put people into certain employment types, because there are many different employment types nowadays. You've obviously got employed, self-employed, you've got contractors and limited company owners and directors. So with regard to employed applicants, length of service is and still remains a big issue. With today's employment market, where there is no longer employment for life, individuals do move fairly regularly, so length of service is a big issue.
So if you've been employed for less than 6 months, the lender may request some sort of reference from the employer, because normally they'd just ask for between 1 and 3 pay slips, wouldn't they?
Indeed, mm. Absolutely. Dependent on the lender as to dependent on what they require. There are lenders out there who actually lend based upon a contract of employment that hasn't yet started. However, a majority of lenders are looking for a period of time or in employment with a particular employer.
And there can be an issue with second jobs, can't there? I mean, I find it strange that, say, the Coventry don't seem to mind if you've got a second job. It just kind of adds on top of your income. But Newcastle will say they'll only take 50%. That's Newcastle Building Society.
No, indeed, yeah. Absolutely.
And it's,
and again, not just with second jobs, but it's the way certain lenders will look at additional payments over and above your basic salary, such as bonuses and overtime payments. Certainly, from the point of view of bonus payments, we're finding someone like the Yorkshire Building Society and Accord Mortgages will take 60% of the annual bonus if it has already been paid, whereas someone like NatWest will look at 100% of regular monthly or quarterly bonuses, whereas a lot of other lenders are not as generous.
Now, if you're self-employed, I mean, people often say that the self-employed get a bit of a raw deal when it comes to residential borrowing. Some lenders require, well, most require 2 years accounts, don't they?
They do tend to get a raw deal, whereas, you know, the employed individual may well get a mortgage based upon a promise of employment. Self-employed have to have that track record in place. So, as you rightly say, you know, most lenders will look at 2 years worth of accounts. However, there's always the potential that we can get exceptions from certain lenders, and 1 year's accounts we'll stand up for them.
But there are a few lenders that will look at the latest year, although they'll want to see the track record, aren't they?
Indeed, yeah, absolutely. They need to see longevity or a period within that self-employment. And if there is a huge uplift in profits or income for that particular year, they may well still look to average, even though they say that they will take that last year's accounts.
Now, Scott, let me come on to you because I want to ask you about auction finance, bridging loans and short-term finance. Lots of terms potentially for the same sort of product, aren't they? What's the difference between all of those?
In all honesty, Richard, not a great deal of difference. They're very, very similar. I do think with regards to the term auction finance, I think it helps focus the mind on a specific situation. And what you will find with clients looking for funding to assist that purchase at auction is a simple Google search of auction finance. But does it differ from short-term lending, a term we prefer, or the term bridging finance? In all honesty, there's no difference.
Okay, and now what sort of situations might you need these loans for? Because people might need them in residential contexts, but often we think about them in terms of people buying perhaps wrecks at auction and maybe even flipping them, and so only needing finance for a short period.
A little bit of all the above. I mean, certainly focusing on auctions, as we're aware, there is typically 28 days to complete. Let's make it sound more scary. 20 working days.
Yikes.
Throw a bank holiday in there. 19 working days. You get the picture.
I've been there many times myself. Yes.
There you are. So speed very, very much it is a factor. Of course, there are on occasion 14-day completions. And I've seen one or two over the years of 7-day completions in auction. But they are quite rare. So speed is a massive factor. You alluded to a point a second or so, Richard, where that the conditions of properties at auction, ripe for modernisation, brilliant for the investor where they can add value and make their profit margin there, but not necessarily mortgageable due to the condition of the property, lack of sanitation, kitchen, structure, Japanese knotweed growing at the back of it, all the above make it difficult for a more traditional lender to assist. And it's in those types of scenarios where short-term finance comes into play, where the client can then remedy the issues, add the value, and then look to flip or refinance with a more mainstream type funder.
Yes, and isn't it incredible that Japanese knotweed can prevent you from getting a mortgage outright, but many lenders, you know, just do not lend to properties that have Japanese knotweed.
Absolutely. I'm pleased to say Together can assist in that situation, and we have done. Of course, with an effective treatment plan, it can be eradicated over a 10-year period.
Of course. Now, what sort of terms are typical in this area? Because it tends to be a sort of monthly lending rate, doesn't it? And my understanding is that you often pay an arrangement fee and sometimes an exit fee when you come out of the loan.
It can be. I mean, I think I actually think it's quite a good time for short-term lending at present because there's lots of competition. And I do genuinely believe that competition is a good thing for the consumer. What number one being it forces down the rates and the terms, and I think it also keeps lenders on their toes to ensure that they have to continue to give a good service. I'm a huge advocate of relationship type lending. That's been my history going back to my banking days. But there is huge competition. You know, rates in the marketplace, I see a whole feast of different numbers. I think looking at the lower end of the scale, and certainly speaking from on behalf of Together, you're looking at 0.49% per month. It's a rate that's available on residential transactions, certain loan to values and so on. In terms of arrangement fees, I've seen everything from no arrangement fee right through to some quite eye-watering figures of 2, 3 and 4 and 5%. But it's not just necessarily these couple of costs. There are some lenders that will charge exit penalties. There are many lenders that will charge a valuation fee, as is expected, but Together on our auction products, it's not something we usually do on residential. And it's the same with lenders' legal fees. Again, the vast majority of short-term lenders will charge often quite high lenders' legal fees. Together don't.
Okay, that's good to hear. And typically across the market, I'd say rates range from about 0.5 to 1%. And some lenders charge arrangement fees and some don't. Let me bring you in, Morgan Stewart. I wanted to ask you about the impact that the Prudential Regulation Authority changes have had on buy-to-let lending. I mean, typically people are finding that they can't get as high a loan-to-value as they used to do. Is that right?
Yeah, the market over the past few years has changed quite a lot. From George Osborne's bombshell with Section 24, and then right through to the PRA rules. So we saw a lot of lenders come out of the portfolio landlord space, and the portfolio landlord is defined as a person who owns four or more mortgage buy-to-let. So the PRA, the Prudential Regulation Authority, issued to lenders guidance that they need to be underwritten on a special case. And one of the things that they brought in was that the portfolio had to be stressed at a minimum interest rate, and also the property they were buying.
Now, a lot of landlords are having to turn to five-year fixes to get a higher loan to value, aren't they? Because the stress test can be a pay rate, can't it, Morgan? But actually, I've never understood why a lot of the mainstream lenders like Virgin Money, TMW, BM Solutions and so on don't actually apply pay rates to their five-year fixes.
No.
You know, they apply something like 4.99 or so on. Why do you think that is?
They do. I think it's the appetite for risk. So they're quite, well, as we say in the industry, they're vanilla lenders. So they like low risk. And I think that's why they implement a higher stress test rating. It is still lower on their five-year fixed products, but it's not pay rate products. Now, there can be a school of thought where if the rules change, some landlords might be locked in, so they don't want to create mortgage prisoners. But a lot of the specialist lenders out there will do the mortgage affordability assessment for the buy-to-let on the pay rate. And generally, I would say some of the cheapest out there now would probably be down in the mid-threes, so stress at a rate of about 3.5% loan-to-value, and that can be for limited company or own personal name. And that just really stretches the amount of money that we can borrow from the lender.
And one of the advantages, of course, of getting company mortgage is that the stress test will be at 125%, not at the 145% that is applied if you're a higher rate taxpayer.
It is, yeah, that's correct. Yeah, they stress on a lower rate than on personal mortgages.
Now, it's interesting to see from National Landlords Association research that, you know, the top lenders are the Mortgage Works, BM Solutions, Virgin Money, Godiva, Paragon. Why do you think these are the lenders that tend to get most of the business with that kind of vanilla buy-to-let?
A lot of it is rate-driven. So the rates are some of the best in the market, especially BM Solutions. I think they've got a sub-2% rate on a remortgage at the moment. So they're very, very good interest rates. So that's going to be picking up the majority of the vanilla buy-to-let business.
Yes, I mean, I looked through on NLA Mortgages today, which has a kind of search engine there, and I found Godiva at 1.39, TMW at 1.44. And what's interesting is they're very close now to the cheapest resi rates, which are 1.21 is the cheapest I could find with Santander. We have to say that they're all at 50% or 60% loan-to-value. But it's interesting to see how that margin on those best buys has really shrunk, hasn't it?
Yeah, they're not. They haven't got the business volumes that they used to have. The majority of new purchases are within a limited company now. So really, a lot of the business that's kicking around for those guys is your remortgage business. And so you see a lot of incentives, so a lot of free valuation, free legals, cash back offers as well from these lenders.
Hmm. Nick, I wanted to ask you about the challenges that face landlords trying to get residential mortgages, because quite often the main source of income is rent, and not all residential lenders like income from rent. Why is that? I mean, landlords are always asking me, why is this?
No, it is a big challenge in today's market. I think a lot of lenders are again, as we've already touched on, risk averse. So they don't like to see clients, applicants with a lot of mortgage debt in the background. So it is a challenge and continues to be. There are certain lenders out there who understand that particular side of the market and are more open to lend to the professional landlord.
I mean, the reality is there's just a handful, isn't there? I mean, we're talking Newcastle Building Society, Virgin Money, Coventry, NatWest.
Barclays as well, yeah.
Barclays, yeah, and I guess then Kensington, but they're more in the specialist area. So, yep. people are quite limited if their main income source is from rent.
So. Absolutely.
Yes. And having a portfolio in the background can also be a burden, can't it? For example, Santander just simply won't lend to you on a residential basis if you have six mortgages or more, or I think six is the limit.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. Yeah, and again, you know, even when the lenders are open to lending to that particular individual, the professional landlord, they do require a lot of information around that portfolio. Someone like Barclays, for instance, will request ASTs on each and every property. They want to see 3 months bank statements to evidence the rental payments coming in and the mortgage payments going out. And they also want confirmation that mortgage is a buy-to-let mortgage. So they almost act as if they're the buy-to-let police.
Yes, and I guess that's partly because there had been some gaming of the system pre-2008 where people bought properties with buy-to-let mortgages but then moved into them, which, of course, is mortgage fraud.
Yeah, very much so. Absolutely.
Yeah, so... Now, Scott, one of the changes that, talking about changes from 2008, was the six-month rule that came in, and that basically means that you can't remortgage a property unless you've owned it for 6 months, and you can't have a standard mortgage on a property if the vendor hasn't owned it for 6 months, and these are kind of UK Finance or Council of Mortgage Lenders, as it used to be called, standard criteria, really. And that, I presume, is one of the reasons why the short-term market has really burgeoned over the last few years.
That's exactly right. And again, just to come back to, I suppose, auctions, you'll find many people that will purchase in a we buy your house for cash type situation, and some of which will in fact flip them in an auction room with the vendor only having owned them for a month. The sad outcome of that is the then purchaser, presumably they're going down the more mainstream route of mortgages, irrespective of the short completion times that we talked around earlier, will quite often get the nasty shock of it being highlighted it's not mortgageable because, of you've quite rightly stated, the vendor's only owned it for a month or two. That's exactly a situation, again, where the short-term lending funding would come into place and assist that client for a period of up to maybe 6 months until they can then get the exit finance in place on more palatable longer term rates of interest.
And who is funding short term lenders like yourselves, Scott? Because it's you know, a lot of them have sort of sprung up, and I'm wondering, is this new money that's come into the market, or how does it work behind the scenes?
I think there's a variety of different lenders with different sort of funding streams behind them. Whether in many instances it can just be affluent individuals, I'm presuming they remain abreast of the various regulations that one must adhere to, or lenders to the size, I suppose, of ourselves together, where our money comes from bank syndication and ultimately bonds.
Okay, well, you're listening to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco. We're talking about getting the right mortgage today. And my guests in the studio are Morgan Stewart, who is principal at GPS Financial, Scott Hendry from Together Money, Nick Blunt, director of One and All Financial Services. Now, Morgan, I wanted to ask you about the return of the refurbishment buy-to-let mortgage, because this was something that was around sort of 10 years or so ago. But we've seen these sort of hybrid products now. I'm thinking of, say, the likes of Precise Mortgages, who will offer you bridging finance, and then that kind of morphs into buy-to-let once you've refurbished the property.
Yeah, so it's generally under the term bridge-to-let. As you know, Precise, they've been quite active in the market. So it basically, the product starts off, the property, it could be auction purchase or a property which is unmortgageable. You'd have to commit to a refurb or conversion to a HMO. Then the product will start as a bridging loan, a bridging loan rate. And then as soon as the works are done, so you can flip it over onto a term mortgage. For example, with the likes of Precise, they ignore the six-month rule. So you don't have to wait 6 months. You can just remortgage it straight into a term product with the same lender. There's a handful of lenders out there who will do that. They've got like Surebook, for example, LendInvest. I think Paragon have come out with something similar recently. So there's a handful of lenders out there who are in this space.
Now, these are specialist lenders, aren't they? And their rates tend to start, I think the cheapest I've found is SBI, State Bank of India, which starts from 3.15%. And then they're kind of, you know, precise rates tend to be 3.3, 3.6, that sort of figure. And they're able to charge those high rates because they don't abide by things like the six-month rule, and also because they do apply pay rates to their five-year fixes, aren't they?
They can do, yeah. And Precise will also allow top slicing on surplus income, so that can be from your portfolio or from your own personal income as well.
Now, top slicing means that if there's not quite enough rent to make the figure stack up on a buy-to-let loan, you can then take account of some of your earned income. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
And so that kind of can make deals happen that otherwise wouldn't do, and certainly wouldn't get through the vanilla-type lenders we've mentioned.
It will do, yeah. So there's a handful of lenders who will allow top slicing. Not all of them. Precise, obviously, being one of them. And when you actually submit your application to Precise, if it's needed, it will work out if top slicing is needed and how much your max loan would be.
Do you tend to find there's any difference between banks and building societies with, you know, signposting clients? Do building societies a little bit more flexible? Are banks a bit more sort of high volume orientated? What differences do you find there, Morgan?
There's massive differences. So obviously we've got banks, lenders and building societies in our space. And they all have it all, every different quirk. Now, some building societies can be absolutely fantastic with certain things. So some of them will have self-build mortgages. Some of them allow short-term let, Airbnb style. And then other building societies can be very, very, very strict and tight with their criteria. So you can find more flexibility and some more quirky stuff with certain building societies. Same with lenders as well. So when I say lenders, I mean, people, not banks or building societies, just lenders who borrow money in and lend money out. They can be a bit more flexible in their criteria. And I say the high street banks can be quite rigid and strict. And then you have the challenger banks. So the likes of Surebook, One Savings Bank, and obviously Precise. Then they can be a lot more flexible in what they're doing. And I know Kent Reliance, for example, a brand of One Savings has really, really pushed forward some of the original HMO mortgages. So they were one of the first lenders to go out and push for the HMOs. So every lender has a different quirk and a different criteria.
Yes, and some of those specialist lenders, it seems, are much more hungry for business than perhaps, say, high street banks. I guess that's the issue, isn't it?
They are. Yeah, they seem, their risk profile is a bit higher. And the specialists, yeah, they exist to challenge the main high street banks, and they've been picking up a large part of the market share.
Mm-hmm. Nick, I wanted to ask you about first-time buyers, and we know that first-time buyer lending has gone up. I think last year we were reporting it had gone up by something like 10%. Is that because of Help to Buy, or are there other factors there?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of factors there. Overall, there's been improved market conditions. I think it's harder for landlords to get a mortgage. So there are fewer landlords in the market where first-time buyers are looking to get on the property ladder. So I think also with regard to the actual mortgage rates at 90% and even at 95%, mortgages have probably never been cheaper for first-time buyers. So and obviously, there are no stamp duty for first-time buyers up to £300,000, whereas the landlords are paying what is the standard stamp duty plus some. So I think, yeah, certainly it's probably not been this good for first-time buyers for 12 years or so.
And the rates have come down incredibly, haven't they? I mean, 95% mortgages now you can get for around 2%, can't you? Whereas a few years ago, they were near 4%.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a a narrowing of the gaps between the loan to value bandings as to what rates are actually available nowadays.
Yes, I mean, it's great if you're a borrower, but it does make me worry that we're heading for sort of bubble territory and perhaps the market's going to have a correction at some point, because it's kind of, it has some familiarity really to the kind of the noughties, I guess.
To a degree, but yeah, I think there's a lot more financial prudence now, so I don't see that that we're heading quite in that direction.
That's true. Everyone learnt their lesson after the
Indeed.
Crash, didn't they?
Indeed.
Or so yeah. We're led to believe. What about first-time buyers, Scott, who are wanting to buy investment properties? I mean, it can be quite tricky for them, can't they? Is that the sort of thing that Together can help them with?
It certainly is. We're happy to assist clients, even if they're not currently a homeowner. If they're looking to buy the first investment, a property that's going to produce them income, that is certainly something that we can consider. And we've noticed the number of people with, I suppose, the emergence of programmes like Homes Under the Hammer, where more first-time buyers now are flocking to, for auction rooms, for example, and also looking to investments as a source of a stream of income. In addition to first-time buyers, we're looking at a number of people coming towards the end of their career also looking to purchase investment property to bolster their pension and so on.
We've talked a bit about regulation. Do you ever feel it's got too burdensome, Scott? I mean, you're a lender and you're having to comply with everything, aren't you?
I'm certainly not going to be anti-regulation. I think it comes down to a couple of things for me. Responsible lending. Let me say that again. Responsible lending is very, very important. But I think it's very important for a lender to maintain a level of common sense. I think that's vitally important in effective lending. I think the term now is specialist lending, which means common sense. And I think hence why we're seeing the emergence of such lenders.
But, you know, some would argue that the stress test of 145% times 5.5% is just, you know, really high. I remember applying for a loan that meant that the mortgage payment would be something like £600, but I had to show £2,400 of rental income. And that just seems absolutely ludicrous.
It does come down to, as I say, that common sense element when lending, but also the lender has a duty of care to the client. That is vitally important. But again, I think, you know, you need to look at the individual circumstances and apply a logic to them to ascertain whether that facility is affordable. I look back now to my first ever mortgage some 20 odd years ago. I won't tell you exactly because I may give away my age. And I look at the stress testing now with that would not have been deemed affordable.
Mm-hmm.
Yet it was very, very affordable. Granted, I didn't have too many evenings out, but I managed to make those mortgage payments without any issue. So I'm hesitant to say it's going too far. But again, just to strip it back and to summarise, I think it's very important for the lender to keep that modicum of sense.
Morgan, I want to ask you about some of the frustrations that I hear landlords talking about on buy-to-let mortgages. Big arrangement fees. I mean, we've mentioned, say, lenders like Precise, they would typically apply 2% arrangement fees. Also, caps, so particularly building societies will say they'll only lend to landlords who've got a maximum of 4 properties or 10 properties. And sometimes things like poor product switch rates. So, for example, TMW now only allows you to go to their loyalty rates, which aren't as good as their new business rates. What do you think about these?
Yeah, there's definitely less choice in the market at the moment after the PRA rules for portfolio landlords. Now, it depends on how many properties you have in your portfolio, but the first, I suppose, milestone would be 4 properties. You lose some lenders then it's 6, you lose some more lenders, and then when you hit 10 properties that you own, it is a very slim market indeed. Of people out there.
I've noticed, for example, that TMW now has a different range for landlords who have more than 10 properties, and they're considerably more expensive.
They do, yeah. And I think a lot of that reflects the work that the lender has to do as well. Because if they're a PRA-regulated lender, then they are, and how they've interpreted the rules, because remember, every lender interprets the rules slightly differently, then I know from experience that a TMW application for a portfolio landlord can be painful. They'll go through all your bank statements, they'll go through your portfolio schedules, they'll do online evaluation of all your properties as well. They might not agree with the valuation you had from your previous lender, especially with the HMO, and you've had a commercial or a hybrid valuation. We get that quite a lot, which is a problem, and we've had cases decline because of that. And I think because of the extra work that these lenders have to put in, then they obviously charge larger arrangement fees for it. And actually, that is the nature of the market at the moment,
But isn't a lot of this, Morgan, down to technology? I mean, if I think about Precise, and I have a Precise loan, I'm a portfolio landlord, and my case kind of whizzed through because it seems to me they use quite a lot of technology. And you know, I've taken out loans with other lenders who are incredibly slow, and the things that they ask for just seem really old-fashioned.
Yeah, it all comes down to the lender's rules and how they interpret the PRA rules and how they underwrite the case. So Precise are great. They're absolutely fantastic portfolio landlords. 3 or 6 months bank statements, portfolio schedule, and a small business plan.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, as long as they'll stress test your portfolio, and as long as it fits in their guidelines, you have a mortgage offer. They're good at what they do.
But of course, you pay for that with the arrangement fee and slightly higher rates than some lenders.
You do.
Yeah. Mm.
You do. And obviously, the Mortgage Works, for example, have some very some nice rates advertised out there, but they're underwriting is much more on the risk-averse side than, say, Precise, for example.
Hmm. Yes, Nick, let me ask you about the joy of underwriters and how they vary so much from one lender to another. It's
Not just from one lender to another.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? And also they seem to underwrite stuff slightly differently if you apply as a customer or go through a broker. Why is this?
I just think it's obviously the lender's individual criteria and how each and every underwriter with their specific mandate reviews that particular case against the criteria that particular provider has. As you quite rightly say, you know, there are certain providers out there that will provide us as brokers a slightly different route to submit business than if you went to them directly, such as one lender that will if you're a limited company director, for example, they will look at salary and dividend if you approach them directly, whereas us as brokers are able to look at salary and the retained profit within the company, which quite often means that the affordability is better by going through us as brokers.
And that can make a big difference, can't it, really, to you not being able to get a mortgage at all, but actually
being able
to get one with somebody through a broker.
Very
yes,
absolutely.
Do you have a view on the pros and cons of going to a small broker or a big broker? Because, you know, there are bigger brokers like TBMC and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that using a broker is a good way of getting the best deal, but whether it's a big broker or a small broker, I think for me, people buy people, so it doesn't really matter if it's a big broker or a small broker. It's the individuals within that particular broker. It's what that broker can actually offer. Does that broker offer access to the whole of the market? It's the scope of the service and the level of service that is provided overall that drives whether you deal with a big broker or a small broker.
Scott, I'm interested to hear your views on brokers, because as a lot of lenders will take business direct and business through brokers. What's the view at Together?
Together are just that. We do a lot of business through the broker market. Equally, we do a lot of business directly. You know, I personally do use a broker for my own personal mortgage, would you believe? Although I am a huge advocate of a client speaking to a lender directly. Often in many situations, because you get the opportunity to speak to a decision maker directly. And whilst many brokers can be a very, very helpful third party, sometimes, present company accepted, you do get that opportunity to speak to the people directly. It's a much more of a living, breathing situation.
Well, I'm really interested in this because I have a few lenders where I feel I have a relationship, a personal relationship with them. There's a small building society I have 4 mortgages with, and they know me by name, and they're very helpful. And, you know, I obviously have to fit all the criteria, etc. But I think they know, you know, I'm a dependable customer. And Do you think that the days of those sorts of relationships are dying, or are they still, is that sort of approach valid?
They're still alive. Just. I'm a huge advocate in relationship type lending, effective account management, whatever term we choose to give it. But I think it's vitally important. One thing that we pride ourselves on is we know our customers. We know who they are. We know who they support, football allegiances, and know if they support Manchester United. It doesn't increase their rate. Forgive me, I support Liverpool.
I play five-a-side football. Would that be helpful?
I will give my age away. I'm 43, Richard. I'm far too old for five-a-side football nowadays. It's hard enough running around with it for the three children. But no, I do think effective account management is very important. So to build a relationship with a good lender, I think is incredibly important. Especially if a client is looking to build a relationship of value for the longer term. And there are situations where a lender applying that level of common sense will go over and above sometimes for a client due to the previous accounts, the previous business conduct, and due to the nature of the relationship. I think it's vitally important.
I'm interested to hear from you, Morgan, on this, because I have a relationship with one of the high street banks. I have a commercial mortgage with them. And of course, in the old days, commercial high street lenders would give you portfolio lending, etc. How has that shifted over the years?
They still do. Certain lenders will still do that. But I think it's much... So the days of personal relationship manager are kind of dying out a little bit in the high street banks, aren't they? I think the business community is highly underserved with the local high street banks. But it is still there. Certain banks are still doing it. So Barclays and Lloyds Bank are very good at it as well. So we introduce business to some of the high street lenders, along with NatWest as well. And they will assign to you a local business development manager to come out, sit down, speak to you about your deal and your case.
There was this period there was this period when they all lost their appetite for lending to property, wasn't there?
They did, yeah. Obviously, the credit crunch. I think a lot of the banks had their fingers burnt with commercial properties laying empty for a long time. And I think a lot of money was lost. So they kind of lost their appetite. But it is there, especially with the likes of Lloyds Bank. They lend a lot to the SME market. And Barclays and NatWest too as well. But you do have to be very squeaky clean. And if you fall out of that tier, then obviously there's a second tier of lenders. So we've got Aldermore in that space, lending in commercial space, Shawbrook, Interbay, and there's a raft of others. I know Together as well, Together in that space. So that's why I think there's been a growth in the second tier market, really.
And how do you think technology is helping or hindering borrowing, Morgan? I'm conscious that some lenders will, you know, say you've got a property where you're not getting the market rent because the tenant's been there for many years. Some lenders will automatically kind of put in the market rent because their system does that for them.
They will do. And obviously, if you depend on the lenders, depends on the technology system they use. I usually prefer. Manual underwrite on a lot of complex cases because it's not computer says yes, computer says no. And I do think there is a risk as we move towards a more digital process where some people can be locked out, especially if there's some slight blips or adverse on the credit file as well. You can get people locked out of the finance market. So I think we need a good balance in the market of manual bespoke underwriting along with technology-driven computer automated processes, really.
Yes, let's finish off actually on the dreaded credit score, Nick. This issue of computer says no. And I remember I had an experience once with a lender where because I had taken out some money on a 0% credit card, which I thought was, you know, very savvy of me to have some free money for a bit. But that suddenly meant that my credit card utilisation meant that my application was declined. I mean, thankfully, this particular lender did respond to me calling to them and speaking to them. And they said, OK, well, that's fine. We'll disregard that loan. But do you find there's much computer says no going on?
Yeah, there is. Shame when it happens, but we understand why it does happen. But we do applaud those lenders who give us the right to actually appeal, and we'll then put a bit of manual override into that computer-generated decision.
It's driven a bit by the DIP, isn't it? The decision in principle, which, you know, the broker will put in all the detail and it will often bounce back a decision straight away. And that's because of credit scoring, isn't it?
It is, yeah. We would sooner, as brokers, see a credit check instead of a credit score and some form of sort of manual intervention and override to make a bit more of an informed decision than a computer-based decision.
Yeah. And there are a few lenders out there that still look at adverse credit. They don't do scoring. They just look to check that there are no CCJs, etc.
Yes, yep, there are.
Probably not many, are there? and also, there are quite a lot of subprime lenders out and about these days, aren't there? And that market has grown, hasn't it, recently?
There are, yeah, where lenders have certain tiers where they will lend through dependent on the credit score and the credit file of that particular individual. Yeah, absolutely.
And Together is one of those lenders, isn't it, Scott? So what's your view on credit scoring and trying to be a bit flexible around
that? We actually don't work off credit score, and credit impairment certainly can be considered. There are many people, for a variety of reasons, that will have blips on their credit file. And again, it comes back down to that human touch. You know, I think technology is vitally important, but ultimately it's there to enhance the customer journey and not to be at its detriment. And I think Nick alluded to it just a couple of moments ago, to have that ability to speak to a human, to apply that element of common sense, I think is really important. It was quite interesting hearing what you said just a moment ago in relation to transferring money over onto a 0% credit card. Sometimes, why would a lender want to impede an individual that is using, I suppose, that knowledge of managing their money more effectively? That's why that human touch that Nick touches on is really, really important.
Well, that's music to my ears. I couldn't agree more. Okay, well, that's it for this programme. Just to remind you that if you are going to take out a loan or mortgage, do speak to a broker or direct to a lender. Do take advice. Obviously, we hope you found the information we've presented as useful, but, you know, take advice as well. You can find all 25 editions of Inside Property and get in touch with us via our website, insideproperty.org.uk. And my thanks to my guests, Morgan Stewart, Nick Blunt and Scott Hendry, and thanks to you for listening.